How often have you seen kangaroo meat for sale at the supermarket and you just sort of shied away from it? It's weird because kangaroo tastes better than lamb. Well, I think so anyway, and it's not so fatty. We have a species of native rice in Australia, which we export to Japan, but very few people eat it here. And then there's the Kakadu plum. If the Kakadu plum came from the Amazon, we'd call it a superfood, because it is. And how about putting these on your shopping list? Warrigal greens, finger limes, magpie goose, desert lime, and pepper berries. My guest today is John Newton. John is a writer and journalist and novelist, and he's been writing about food and food cultures around the world for decades. He's been a restaurant reviewer, and he's co-written several cookbooks. And his latest book is called The Oldest Foods on Earth, A History of Australian Native Foods. And these are foods that sustained and delighted people on this continent for many thousands of years. And John thinks it's high time we let ourselves enjoy our native ingredients. International chefs love this stuff, so why don't we? Hi, John.
Yeah, Richard, how are you?
It's late summer. If you were having friends over for dinner tonight and all the native ingredients you wanted just happened to be in the supermarket, fully stocked, what would you make for dinner tonight?
And that is a big question. Mm-hmm. I would probably get my barbecue extremely hot and do some kangaroo loin, and then I would already made a sauce of ribberries, which have that lovely tangy clovey flavour, which would go very well with kangaroo. I would then probably do something like, if I had all the fruits, I'd try and do maybe Kakadu plum, native banana with a kwandong as a fruit salad, and maybe with a Davidson plum sauce on that.
That sounds fabulous. The ribberries you're talking about, is that the same thing as lily pilly?
There's a lot of controversy, but not controversy, argument about this. The tree is a lily pilly, but the fruit is the ribberry.
Right.
But when the French took it over and made a jam out of it, they decided to call them lily pilly fruit.
Oh, okay. Now, your love of native food started with you eating it, of course. So yeah. Tell me about the dish you had way back in the 90s that you couldn't forget.
1993, a wonderful restaurant with a wonderful chef called Philip Searle, who's one of the great Australian chefs. And it was kangaroo with a pickled beetroot sauce. And I remember ringing Philip at the time and saying, how did you make that sauce? And he regaled me for half an hour with all the ways he'd done it by combining, you know, Vietnamese and Chinese and all sorts of techniques. But it was just a beautiful dish. And what the most important thing for me at the time, I thought, this may be the only item of native produce, Australian native produce, I've ever eaten, except for the macadamia, which, of course, I thought was Hawaiian. Of course, it wasn't.
I think I might have too, to this point.
Well, no surprise, because that's where it started to be marketed. So I began to think about that, and I began to start exploring that, because it seemed to me, you know, I didn't have any idea of the extent of food we had on this island before. And then I began to start talking to chefs like Jean-Paul Brunetto, Andrew Felke in Adelaide, and I just learned the extent of the foods that we had here that we were just not even beginning to... We hadn't looked at for 200 years.
Are tastes more advanced in different places rather than others? Like in Adelaide, I know there are a lot of restaurants that are attached to pubs. This isn't high fine dining or anything, but restaurants attached to pubs that will serve really nice dishes with kangaroo and emu in them. Yep. That's Adelaide, but I've not seen it elsewhere in Australia.
Well, kangaroo was, until 1993, illegal in most states, except Adelaide, except South Australia. I think in South Australia, humans were allowed to eat it. I could be wrong, about 1980.
Wow.
You still can't have a kangaroo abattoir in Western Australia.
You say that the magpie goose is probably the most succulent game bird in the world. I've never heard of the magpie goose. Yeah. Where is it from? And tell me more about it, please.
They were over a lot more of the country. They were in fact shot and hunted in the southern part. They were actually hunted out of Victoria. So they've all retreated north, and now they're mostly up around Northern Territory. And there are millions of them. There's a hunting season in the Northern Territory, and you can hunt them. But for some reason, we aren't allowed to. Until quite very recently, we're not allowed to have. Nobody's allowed to go up there and take them out and bring them down to us just to eat. It is beautiful, beautiful meat.
Right, and who eats it today?
People who hunt can eat it. Indigenous people are allowed to take as many as they like. a farmer called Richard Garner, or a butcher called Richard Garner, a wild game butcher, has now got permission to take 4,000 of those animals out of the territory every year.
And how does he catch them?
Well, interesting story. His original intention, he was up there. He was up there on another project, and he learnt that the mango farmers of the Northern Territory were very angry at the magpie geese because they'd become fond of mangoes.
Oh, right. So they were a pest.
As soon as the mangoes were ripe, they'd swoop on the groves and eat out all the mangoes. So the farmers were killing and poisoning the magpie geese. And Richard, who knew about the flavour of these things, said, hang on, I can come in and trap them before then and take them down south and sell them in restaurants and sell them to people who want to eat them. So he teamed up with some Larrakia people, including a guy who was a ARL hero up there.
Right.
I forgot the name of the guy, Adam Millpot, I think his name is. He formed a company with them. He got permission from the Northern Territory government to put traps in the mango groves, and that's how it was going to happen. In speaking to him recently, that didn't work because the mango farmers didn't want to wait until the animals wandered into the traps. They wanted to start killing them immediately before they started killing eating their mangoes. So now he and the Larrakia people he's working with herd them into traps further away. Last year he got about 1,700 processed, and he's working up towards the 4,000 and hopefully more. It's something that should be on our tables.
The Larrakia people you're mentioning there, they're also catching green ants as well. What are they using those for?
Well, that's interesting. Because there wasn't enough work to keep them going with the processing of the magpie geese, they looked around for other things, and one of those was the green ant. They have gone on to do quite astonishing things with green ants. Chris Lloyd, she's a cheesemaker in South Australia, entered her green ant cheese in an international competition in San Sebastian and got the prize, the top prize.
A
green ant cheese.
What do you mean? Like, is it just like...
I never tried it.
Ground up and put into the cheese or something?
I have no idea how they do it. I'm waiting to try it. A friend of mine in Sydney is bringing some in.
And what does a green ant cheese taste like?
According to the judges at San Sebastian, fantastic. Tangy, citrusy. It's got a citrus flavour, the green ants. Oh, they're also making it into a gin, green ant gin.
A gin,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing that green ants have to then sort of be sort of ground up, put into a cheese, sent over to Spain for it to be to be kind of recognised. What are some of the other Australian native game birds that we could be eating,
John? Well, the most interesting one to me, and this has got an environmental edge to it too, because birds have smaller footprints when we raise them than do big animals, you know. And so if the more birds we eat, the less that we're impacting on the environment. The scrub turkey, or bush turkey, or some people call it a bush chicken.
Bush turkey, brush turkey, bush chicken, scrub turkey, it's all the same beast.
It's protected.
It? Yes.
But it's a pest.
Right.
People where it proliferates get angry at it. And yet Mrs. McClurkin, Hannah McClurkin, in the mid-19th century, said she served it to her guests as pheasant and they didn't know the difference. It tastes wonderful.
They're good eating, are they?
They're very good eating.
I have wondered about that.
Yeah.
I've had a couple in my backyard and thought, yes, and making
a giant
vast cone of garden refuse. And I was thinking, that'd be good eating, right.
Well, so, the bustard, Captain Cook said something like, the finest tasting game bird he tasted outside of England. The wonga pigeon, the little crested pigeon, called when it was sent to England in one of those wonderful acclimatisation societies, the queen of pigeons. And all these things are here, and we don't eat them.
I've had emu in the form of an emu tartare at a restaurant in Brisbane, where it was ground up and mixed with, you know, very, very finely chopped onions and other bits and pieces and spices and herbs, whatever, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Is emu being eaten in Australia?
Emu is being eaten very little. In fact, most of the kangaroo is being exported. 70% of the kangaroo we catch is exported.
You say the CWA, the Country Wounds Association, used to have an emu egg recipe or several emu egg recipes in their cookbooks.
In the first edition.
Oh, okay.
Which is, I think, 1937, 1937.
Right, 1937,
The next edition, it was gone.
Oh.
All they did was they just substituted emu for chicken eggs, and they said you can use emu eggs in this and that, you know, and then the next edition, it was gone.
Right.
And I went through all their books. I sat in their library, which used to be in King's Cross in Sydney, and went through them all. The only vague reference to an indigenous ingredient was the kangaroo biscuit, which had no kangaroo in it, of course.
But emu eggs being used for omelets and other dishes like that.
Yeah.
And it's gone now. Would you be able to buy emu eggs at a market anywhere in Australia?
I don't see why not, but I really don't know. You see them hollowed out and used as decoration, but I don't know whether you can buy the egg with the ingredients in it.
Now, there is a native rice on the market I mentioned earlier called Alpine rice. What is alpine rice?
Alpine rice is one of the two native rices in Australia. The other one, I've forgotten the name of it, but the other one is very difficult to... The alpine rice you mentioned is being exported. I've never seen it anywhere. I'm sure you could get it if you started searching for it online. But they're dry land rices too. They don't need to be irrigated.
Oh, really? Yeah, so, all right. So they're being native. They're used to the harsher conditions, right?
Yeah. The one that's being investigated now by a Dr. Penny Worm at I think the Charles Darwin University has a little problem with it. You can't husk it. Any attempt to husk it has broken all the machinery. She's been working on it for a long time, and she reckons she'll crack the problem very soon, and we'll then have that. But the important thing about these native rices is they are actually rices. They're from the Oryza genus, and they are very early and unchanged rices. So they'll be very important for the gene pool, the international gene pool of rices, if anything ever happens.
It's remarkable that they're being exported, this rice is being exported to Japan. Mm. If there's no country in the world more finicky and fussy about its rice than the Japanese. Yeah. Is there evidence that Aboriginal people cultivated this alpine rice?
I don't know about the alpine rice, but I do. There's an anecdote about the other rice. A woman who is working as an Indigenous woman who's working as a research assistant with Penny Worm said, "I wish I had spoken to my grandmother about this and I could find out how it was used. It was eaten, but how it was eaten, who knows, because it was they didn't have any methods of boiling in those pre-1788. So how they prepared the rice, who knows?"
You mentioned earlier the Kakadu plum, which is grown in northern Australia. Mm. What's happening with that up in Broome at the moment?
Very interesting stuff in Broome. A guy called Kim Courtney, who works for the Broome TAFE, Kim is working with a guy called Meridu Walbidi, who is on a community called Bijinunga up near Broome, and he was one of the last Indigenous people to walk out of the desert. And he's now an artist and a horticulturist with and a very good friend of Kim's. And they are doing something called savanna enrichment, which goes to the way of Indigenous farming, which was fire stick farming or cool burning. You know, it's a very long and complicated story, but what they do is they go to an area, and they've been doing this on a large area near Broome, and they will, over 4 years, they just burnt off all the wild acacia that had grown there because the fireproof acacia, because huge fires used to roar through, and the only things that withstand it, the grasses went, everything went except this acacia. So they burnt that off, and they gradually, when they cleared the land, they replaced it with Kakadu plum trees, or they call it gubbins up there and they started them off with a little bit of gentle irrigation, and now they have crops of gubbins. On Bijinunga, they got 700 kilograms of Kakadu plum last year, and it will grow because it's a very important and highly regarded ingredients in the cosmetic industry and all sorts of things as well. And we don't eat it, but we should be eating it as well.
It's in the cosmetic industry?
Oh, yeah.
How would you use a plum? I'm a bit naive about this stuff. What do they use plum?
It's a very famous case where an American company called Mary Kay came out here and began to work with Indigenous people in the north on developing gubbins for use in, I don't know what point.
Colour, maybe, I suppose.
It's supposed to be good for your skin. I have no idea. It's probably BS, you know. But
who knows?
Yeah. But what they did, the Mary Kay people, was they went back to America, applied for a patent to use it, won a patent to develop it in America, and they're now producing it in America.
Kakadu plums,
the Kakadu plums, from which they're taking an extract and they put in their cosmetics, which is a danger because this has happened more and more with these things.
How big are we talking about? A plum the same size as your average plum you buy
in the
supermarket?
No, they're about pear-shaped.
Pear-shaped. Oh, yeah, they're that big.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And as I said, they're
teardroppier.
A teardroppier. Okay. I think that's a proper adjective. And They're often called a superfood. Why are they called a superfood?
Because of the extraordinary amount of antioxidants, lutein, and especially vitamin C. I mean, there was one specimen was recorded by Jenny Brand Miller years ago in the Human Nutrition Unit at Sydney University with something like 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C in it. I mean, a huge amount, 200 times more than an orange.
Wow, in piece, you know? 200 times more than an orange.
Yeah. It's a hugely full of all the kind of things that that we're told we should eat.
Like I said, if we were told it came from the Amazon, there'd be a chain of smoothie shops dedicated to the Kakadu plum, probably.
Yes, all our superfoods come from exotic places. But I'd like to eat them, you know? Mm. They're a red and yellow variety, so they're incredibly good to eat.
Why does Australia have such an enormous variety of edible plants?
This is a question that goes back a long way, millions of years, I think. It goes back to the fact that we were part of a thing called Gondwana land. And we then had to, these plants that we had to survive extraordinary ranges of temperature and arid conditions after we broke off. And we stayed down here. I mean, I think the best example of that is I give us the pepperberry, the Tasmania lanceolata, the pepperberry, which has 30 different phenolic compounds, which it has developed to keep going through all these different climatic changes it's had to put up with from Antarctic temperatures up to now.
So you're saying that the harsh conditions
harsh
of Australia
conditions, half conditions.
Have made these fruits very sophisticated?
Harsh conditions, poor soils.
Right.
I mean, it's the old, it was a pretty terrible thing, we used to say, treat them mean and keep them keen.
Right.
But that's part of the story with the plants.
How prepared were Aboriginal people historically? What do we know about that to actually avail themselves of this huge range of foods?
Well, they had to. It's all they had.
Yes.
You know, it's all they had. I mean, the Western Desert, which was a very, very harsh climate, but even in the Western Desert, they had to choose from, in good seasons, 150 different kinds of foods.
150?
Yeah.
In the desert?
In the Western Desert. Yeah.
And how many different kinds of foods do most Australians avail themselves
of
these
days? Unless you're the sort of person who, you know, calls yourself a gourmand and eats everything available, probably 80 to 90, and even above that, we wouldn't go much beyond 100.
So are you saying people in the Western Desert had a more variegated diet than contemporary Australians
Not
do?
The sort of things we might like to eat.
Right.
I mean, we wouldn't eat baby budgerigars with their heads ripped off, poached in ash. We wouldn't eat, they'd catch the goanna, or the big lizards and the goannas, and they would mash them into a pulp and dry that and into a paste. And that would keep them for a long time. But there were a lot of foods there, a lot of variety of foods.
Aboriginal people took a different view of seasonality too, didn't they? Particularly in the north of
Australia.
Well, they had to, yes.
Yeah,
seasons that, I mean, Europeans came and brought the four seasons, the idea of the
we
four seasons.
We decided they had four seasons here that were in the Northern Hemisphere, which is, I mean, in the Arnhem Land, they've got seven, which are based upon, seven or eight, they're based upon observations of what is fruiting, what is flowering, what animals are extant at the time. They're not just imposed seasons. They are observational seasons.
And this is a kind of a story that comes from thousands and thousands of years use of the land. It's evolved over time and use and trial by error brought to bear again and again and again. Starting with the plants, John, berries and fruits seem quite obvious. What other parts of native plants were eaten other than the berries and fruits? Typically, were they roots?
Tubers, cycad cones.
Is that Banksia cones?
Banksia cones.
How are they eating cones?
And cycads, you know, the cycad, which is one of the oldest plants. There's a cone in that, and that was the one that made Leichhardt very sick until he learned how to treat it.
Right. How did he do that?
Well, he taught himself. He spoke to the indigenous people.
Right.
It seemed like a fairly normal thing to do, but many early Australians didn't bother to ask them how they ate things. They just tried to eat themselves and got sick.
And this was the pandanus, was it?
This is the
pandanus or the
pandanus.
Cycad? Right. Okay.
Yeah,
and how did he treat the? How were they treating the pandanus for it to make it edible?
I think they were soaking it. Right. I think they were doing. They were roasting it. I think cassava is the same thing. You have to do several things to cassava before you can eat it.
Now, this is the real shock for me. Aboriginal people were eating native truffles. We have native truffles in Australia?
We don't know how many they ate. We do know from mycologists that there are about 1,000 underground fungi, which is what a truffle is, an underground fungus, of which we've only know of one that was eaten, which is called charmingly Blackfella's Bread. And and it's a friend of mine has eaten it, and he said it's pretty bland.
Right.
But that leaves 999 that could be terrific. And I spoke to a mycologist once, and I said, who was, you know, an expert in these things. He said, "Do you taste them?" He said, "No, we just categorise them." So somebody's got to go out there and do the hard yards, and there may be a Perigord truffle down there somewhere.
Why wouldn't you want to try? Why? I mean, that seems like you're calling it something a truffle. You'd surely want to taste it, I would have thought. Right. I mean, my understanding of how truffles work is that they grow at the root of the base of a tree in Europe, and then there's pigs to come in.
There's a symbiosis with an animal.
Yes.
It's with bitongs and other animals.
There is a symbiosis
here. There's a same kind of symbiosis.
What marsupials come along and root them out, do they? And root them out. So that's the pig of the Australian truffle,
right,
is it? What other meats were eaten in pre-colonisation Australia, apart from kangaroo and goanna?
Well, wallaby, magpie goose, of course, a Cape Barren goose, snakes. You know, a snake can feed a whole tribe, you know, a good snake. So everything everything was eaten. Eels, especially eels, were... At Gunton Mata in Western Victoria, the eels were farmed and traded as trade.
How were they farmed?
There was a volcanic lava, Darlett's Creek is a lava-formed creek, and they would dam the eels off, allow them to grow, and then they would come and they would catch them in a long basket, which underground, and then they would keep them and trade them with their neighbouring clans for swap things.
How typically were Aboriginal people catching fish?
A lot. They catch fish.
Yeah, with nets or with...
Yes, they would net. They netted river fish.
Right.
But the sea fish were caught with spears, and they were very accurate with that as the early colonists saw them spearing.
How about other animals? How were they being cultivated? Is that the word? I'm not kept.
No,
herded or in a way.
Herded because of this. Going back to fire stick farming, with the fire stick farming, they transformed the landscape. If you've ever seen a painting by Eugene von Guérard, you'll see that. It looks like what the early colonisers called a park, by which they meant a gentleman's meadow, a gentleman's park, a gentleman around an estate.
An estate, yes.
Because they managed to manicure the landscape so that there was long open grassland with the trees on the ridges. So that open grassland made it much easier for them to farm. And they would also often herd the animals into defiles, into cabins, and kill them that way. So they didn't have to... You know, they didn't have to, or they couldn't have fenced them off anyway, because they
leap over.
Kangaroos leap a bit.
This is Conversations with Richard Feifler on ABC Radio.
There's a wonderful description of a traditional method of how to kill and cook a turtle in your book, John. Tell me about that, how a turtle is
wonderful.
I should preface this by saying, years ago I interviewed Tanya Major, who was from Far North Queensland, and she was talking about going back to eat some, having some sea turtle when she went back home, and I said, "Oh man, what's that like?" And she said, what do you want me to say, Richard? It's like chicken. It's not like chicken. It tastes like turtle. I mean, oh, okay. All right. Fair enough.
Well, it's not the sort of thing that I don't think we're going to be doing in our own kitchens. You get the turtle, you cut its head off, mm-hmm. and you put your hand inside and you pull out all the innards and the eggs.
And are the eggs eaten as well?
The eggs are eaten too. Right. Yeah, the eggs are cooked in the sand they're still soft, and they're cooked in the warm sand underneath the fire.
So once you've pulled all the innards out and all that out, what happens then?
They eat the innards, of course. Mm. I know that when Indigenous people kill a kangaroo, all the innards are given to the elders, because they're the parts with the most nutrients in them.
Right.
So I just remember Luck saying they eat the innards. Then they take the turtle in its shell, and they put in a herb from a tree. It's called jiklia, which is used also for a smoking ceremony because it has a wonderful flavour. So that's the use of a herb in Indigenous cooking, which is quite interesting. And then the animal itself is put in its shell on the fire, and it kind of stews inside the shell in the fire. Then they eat when it's cooked. It sounds
amazing. Yeah. I've spoken to Aboriginal people from around Broome in the northwest, and of course they're influenced there by curries and other food from Southeast Asia and use indigenous ingredients then make that into a curry. And they talk about it all the time. They talk about their food in the way that Singaporeans talk about food, which is obsessively all the time, and about curry and what makes a good curry.
It's a fusion. That's a really fascinating, unexplored part of Australian cooking. Those sort of New Guinea and Makassan and all the other influences that have come in.
A large part of the question you want to ask here is why we haven't, why the country or the larger country has not been, well, has been so slow to adopt these native foods that are plentiful in many places, that are suited for local soils and climate and all those things, and often taste so utterly delicious. And we have to start with the arrival of the British in 1788, along with the First Fleet. Mm. What kind of foods were brought along with the First Fleeters and Second Fleeters and so on?
Everything we eat now, all the livestock, all of the vegetables and the fruits, everything was brought with them. They brought everything with them, including a most destructive form of agriculture. Now, I mean, you can't blame people for doing a trip which must have been equivalent to a trip to the moon with bringing in their own food, especially when Joseph Banks, who should have known better, said there's not very much to eat there. Because Banks took a lot of specimens back.
You know? Wow, and he was a botanist.
So they were expecting, and of course, the Cook and Banks, they're only here for a short while. They're up the coast, and then they're off.
Then they're off. Mm.
So these people came out here expecting to find very little to eat. So they brought it all with them. And they all brought with them attitude, too. They were the Georgian English, and they were the masters of the world. They were sort of like, if you like, the Americans of their day. They were in charge of everything, and they saw themselves superior. Their culture was superior, and they found themselves confronted by naked, wandering savages, as they saw them. So they never really thought to question them about anything.
Yeah, but if they'd looked closely, they would have seen those Aboriginal people were fit, trim, not a bit of extra fat on them, and better nutrition than they had, probably.
There were a couple of exceptions. I mean, Dawes, for example. You know, Dawes bothered to learn the language. William Dawes bothered to learn the language, but then he got kicked off for refusing to go on a massacre, which Philip had ordered. But it was basically pretty well ignored, except in times of hardship. When they had to, they'd eat things. There's something around Sydney called native sarsaparilla, which Watkin Tench said was used and was used to ward off scurvy that was made into a drink,
right.
And they would have eaten also Warrigal greens, which was eaten by Cook. In fact, the first meal ever eaten of Australian ingredients was on the Endeavour, and it was tripe of skate, whatever that means, and Warrigal greens.
Tripe of skate, the lining of a skate's stomach?
Exactly. And Banks recorded that, you know, and it's like our Thanksgiving. It should be like our Thanksgiving meal, the first Australian meal book.
I have to say, I'm glad it's not. Never been a tripe fan myself. Yeah. So it could have obviously also been quite dangerous for these new arrivals to eat the plants that were poisonous and would have given them terrible trouble.
If they'd only asked, of course.
There's a great story from Watkin Tench, who wrote about the very first Aboriginal dinner guest, a man named Arabanu. Tell me that story, please.
Well, I contrast it with the story of the first Thanksgiving dinner in America, which was, you know, there's a lot of contention about it, but there's no doubt that at the first crop that the pilgrims did, they invited the local people who'd helped them with the crops to come and eat, and they ate together, and they sat down together at the table as equals and ate. Things didn't go too well after that, but that was the beginning. Arabanu was captured because the English authorities had asked the colonists to have intercourse wherever possible to try to understand the people that lived here, the indigenous people who lived here. And they, quite understandably, after realising that they weren't going to go away, the Europeans, they were reluctant to come up close, and they were reluctant to have anything to do with them. So Philip set out a party, and they captured two. One of them got away. The one who didn't get away was a guy called Arabanu. And Arabanu was taken forcibly to Government House and sat at a side table at the governor's table and given a European meal.
Oh, right.
And
did he eat it?
Well, he ate. He didn't eat the bread. Didn't like the bread much. He wouldn't drink the alcohol, But he ate the meat and the fish.
Does it say how he ate them? Did he eat them with relish or terror? Or
he apparently quite enjoyed, from what I can get from Tench, and I think I'm not too sure whether Tench is the only witness to this. He enjoyed the fish. Well, the fish is fish.
You know? I suppose hospitality is hospitality too, isn't it? There's an understanding.
He was dragged to the table, tied. He wasn't. He didn't want to come. When he was caught, Tench says he let out a wailing and a screaming, and he wanted to get away. But so he was tied with ropes and taken to the table, which is a distinct contrast to the first Thanksgiving meal.
Indeed. So, what did he once he'd eaten this meal of English food? What did he do after that?
Well, his table manners were quite good, apparently, except he threw the plate out the window.
Why?
Well, because he would have, if he'd eaten off a leaf, he would have thrown the leaf out the window. So he didn't quite understand that, you know. But he was quite dignified at the table and used his when he was told not to wipe his hands in the seat, he used a napkin that was provided him. So
there was a dogged determination to make that food from Europe work in Australia.
Yeah.
It took a long while to make that happen, though, didn't it? It took a long while.
Well, it did because of a couple of things. First of all, I don't think there was a real farmer in the First Fleet. There were people who had done farming. Secondly, according to a wonderful little booklet put out by the Sydney Botanic Gardens, the implements they brought with them were pretty terrible and they broke. And the soil around Sydney isn't fantastic where they planted. So many, many crops failed. So it wasn't until they moved up towards the Hawkesbury that the crop started to do well. And that's where they came across one of their very first confrontations, and a very important confrontation with the local people. I don't know whether you saw The Secret River, the film.
Indeed, yeah.
Do you remember where the little scene where the guy came up and waved the little yellow daisy in front of the settler, whose name I've forgotten, in that film, and seemed to be yelling at him about it? Well, that was the daisy from the yam daisy or the murnong. And what the settler had done was, in planting his crops, he had upset the murnong, which was one of their staples, the yam daisy, which is a tuber, the tuber of the yam daisy, murnong. And he just trampled all over their crop.
There were some faltering attempts by the newcomers to take to the native foods. And you tell the story of there's an organisation in the 19th century called the Acclimatisation Society of Victoria. What were they about?
They were about bringing things out to Australia from the old country to make life better. Wonderful things like rabbits. They brought out rabbits.
Oh, it was them, wasn't it?
They brought out privet. And they brought out foxes so the chaps could have some hunting. But there was also an attempt to take things back. One of the things they took back, which was the Murray cod, which didn't work very well. So they had this acclimatisation dinner, which was, to us these days, amusing. In those times, 19th century, every English meal of a certain level was always in French. So on the menu you had épinard de wombat, avec épinache, I could get it wrong, which is thinly sliced wombat with spinach, and pâté de paroquet. But they tried these things, and they were very pâté de paroquet, of course, is parrot pâté.
Yes.
But they were very complimentary of the flavour of these foods, but nothing happened. You know, they spoke about the magpie goose with relish, and the report in the Melbourne Argus said it was wonderful tasting, but you know, it didn't stick.
Were people in Australia catching on to local fish by then? Surely, I mean, fish weren't so alien to them. Were snapper and
fish and oysters? Snapper, snapper was for some reason rejected, according to a report I read. One woman said it's not fit to be served at the table.
Really?
Yeah, really.
God,
weird.
It's pretty premium these days, isn't it? It's a gorgeous fish.
It's a beautiful fish, oysters, of course. Oysters are oysters. Mm-hmm. Prawns are prawns, all those sorts of things. But the snapper was one quick, curious one. It was seen as not fit for the table. They'd rather have tinned salmon.
In around about the 80s and 90s, there were some key chefs who tried to re-establish these foods. First of all, tell me about Jean-Paul Brunetto, please.
Well, Jean-Paul Brunetto, the story of Brunetto and Cherikov, Vic Cherikov, is mixed. Vic Cherikov was a very interesting man. He's still around. He's still dealing in native foods. He got a job with the Human Nutrition Unit at Sydney University to go out to the places where these foods grew, bring them back to Australia, sort of Sydney, I should say, bring them back to Sydney so they could be examined. In fact, it was a human nutrition unit that first examined the Kakadu plum and discovered its extraordinary nutritive properties. But Vic, in probably what was a little bit of a naughty way, he wasn't probably supposed to do this, had heard of a restaurant run by a guy called Jean-Paul Brunetto, where he was attempting to start what he called an Australian cuisine, and he was looking for Australian ingredients. So Vic would drop by Jean-Paul's kitchen on the way to the university and drop things off with him. And Jean-Paul was a young Frenchman who had come to Australia at the age of 12. And as he said to me later, like a Frenchman, I looked around and saw, what is there to eat? And he started experimenting with these. And his experimentations were the first attempt at what I call the gastronomy of translation, because the way we use this food is not the way the indigenous people use this food. As Jean-Paul himself says, the Aboriginal people did not have barramundi with lemon, myrtle, beurre blanc. They did not do that.
Not that we're aware of.
That's right. Yeah. So Jean-Paul was taking these foods that Vic supplied into his kitchen and interpreting them and making them work in a European context.
And was there an appreciative audience, crowd, dining public for
there,
this?
There was, but the critics were not convinced. The critics often looked down upon this as tourist food. And in many ways, they were right, because the tourists flocked to the restaurants. The visitors to Australia loved these new flavours, and they thought they were wonderful. And there was a resistance to this amongst many, many Australians. And I think this is where we get into this problem of food racism at the beginning.
It's a strong term, food racism. Yeah, this is the underlying problem here. This is why you think Australians, by and large, have not been attracted to native foods.
I think that's one of the underlying problems. I think availability is another one. Raymond Kirsch, who is a wonderful cook of indigenous chef in his table of indigenous produce. At first, he didn't tell his customers in the first restaurant what he was using. He said, I'd use them for flavour. When they went to their next restaurant, he put on the menu what produce he was using and what products he was using. And he had an old customer of his, who had been a very good customer from the previous restaurant, come up to him and say, Raymond, why are you using this Abbo shit?
Wow, that was the phrase?
That was the phrase. And that, when I heard that from Raymond, that horrified me. And then I began to think about it. I mean, it is horrible, but it does show you the power of food culturally. You know, food is more than just something you ingest and excrete. Food is a cultural expression. And that's a very big thing. We've changed now, by the way. I think we've come a long way.
If that's true, then why have Australians been so quick to grasp food from elsewhere in the world? We've adopted food from everywhere. Southeast Asia and elsewhere in the world much more quickly than other English-speaking countries.
Well, does it not? There is a special corner of hell deserved for racism against the Aboriginal people. I think we've seen that quite a lot. Adam Goods. You know, and all sorts of things. I was exploring the internet while I was writing this book, and there were things I left out because I wouldn't put them in. And some of the things that are said about Indigenous Australians online are just too horrible.
Do you think part of it is the fact that the first European arrivals were English, British by and large, English, and Britain has a different kind of food culture to the continent. It just does, and we kind of all know this. I've always found that Britain's, so much of its ideas of food are bound up in nostalgia. This idea that the food makes you feel safe. Comfort food's a very big thing, which is why the British have endured such dreadful food for so long, because they've always had it. I mean, whereas the French have a different attitude. I mean, each culture has their strengths and weaknesses. That's true. But the French will, a Frenchman, like you mentioned, like Brunetto, will arrive and go, well, what are the local ingredients? Mm. How can I get this locally and then put it into food and create new things with it? Yeah. The English are more about, I want something that reminds me of childhood or something like that. What do you think of that?
Well, we've been eating that food for 200 years. I mean, that's the second gastronomy we have in this country, the gastronomy of nostalgia. And we've eaten what was brought in 1788, more or less, up until 1945. That's all we've eaten. But the extraordinary business of accepting everything, that is quite extraordinary, because we did. We leapt on everything. We would eat anything. Stinking tofu, you know.
But when it comes to local native food,
there's still a reluctance.
It's a stubbornness? What is it?
Well, as I say, I think now it's probably also the lack, or the 200 years of neglect, And I think it's also the lack of ability to buy. It's the lack of availability of these things. When I went to buy the pepper berries to have with the kangaroo I bought, I couldn't find any pepper berries. It took me weeks to get the kangaroo.
David Maloof remembered on this program when he was a kid, his parents were Lebanese extraction. He remembers them having to buy olive oil from a chemist. They were sold in little vials from the chemist as a kind of, I don't know, for your skin or something like that, I suppose, or something you drink like castor oil. That changed. There's plenty of olive oil in our supermarkets now.
Well, something happened in 1972. Now, the first migrants started to arrive en masse in 45, and then from 1945 to 72, there was pretty well, I've recorded in other things I've written about people being told not to cook with garlic because it makes the whole neighbourhood stink and, that sort of thing. But something happened in 1972. First of all, we were doing quite well and we had disposable income. Then a large aeroplane arrived, the jumbo jet. And then Australians en masse, huge numbers of Australians began to go out to the world. They hadn't before then. We'd been very insular. We went to Europe, we went to Asia, and we discovered, we came back and we thought, maybe Luigi next door knows a thing or two, maybe I must go and find out what he's eating. So we ate those foods in Asia and Europe on site, in situ, and we came back, and that was the reason for the acceptance, I think.
Do you think taste might be an issue with native foods insofar as most of the produce we get these days originates from other countries is a lot sweeter than it used to be? Is the sugar in produce an issue here?
I think that's probably true. Most of the native fruits are certainly not as sweet as the modern versions of European fruit we get.
Yeah, like how much has pineapple changed over the years?
That's right, yeah. I can get pineapples at my greengrocer, they will tell me when they come in they're tart and they're not very sweet. But those ones you buy with the tops lopped off so you can't plant them and grow them, they've been bred to be very, very sweet. And I think that's our tastes. I love the tart flavours, the ribery flavour of tartness and cloviness. It's a much more interesting flavour than just pure sugarised flavour. But that could be a problem.
René Redzepi from Noma, one of the world's most famous chefs. Often these restaurants often rated in, the one in Denmark is rated as the world's greatest restaurant periodically. He came here a few years ago and he was very interested in native ingredients. There is this interest from overseas chefs, again, in our native ingredients. Right. But then there are local chefs like Kylie Kwong who are starting to use native ingredients as well. How are people like Kylie Kwong using these?
Well, just go back to René. René came here in 2010. And he had been named as the best restaurant in the world. And I say, sotto voce, what does that mean? But, he came out here and did good things. He spoke of the Opera House. And the basic tenor of his speech was, you have these terrific ingredients here, but you aren't using them. What's wrong with you? This is the basis of my food in Denmark. I have gone out into the forests and the seaside, and I have found they've got not much there, believe me, lichens and things like that, and I'm using them in my cuisine. And a lot of the young chefs who were at that talk in the Opera House in 2010, including Kylie Kwong, heard that, and they didn't have the baggage of racism that was 10, 20 years before that. I think we've changed. I think there's green shoots of progress happening here in our attitude to Indigenous Australians. I mean, I know there is.
When we talk about this kind of food, though, we're talking about top international chefs using it. Is there a sense that that's a bit too precious and a bit too fussy? I mean, isn't the point really to get it on, on the dinner table of everyday people?
Well, we know that trickle-down economics doesn't work, but trickle-down gastronomy does, because foods that appear on the menus of the major restaurants have a habit of trickling down to the table.
Yeah, they get picked up on MasterChef and My Kitchen Rules, and they get sort of, it's like, now make one of these at home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That kind of thing. And maybe there's change coming in that level.
And the next minute they're in Coles and Woolworths and people are buying them. And I think but it's got to start somewhere, We've got to have enough of these things. There are producers who are doing very well. There's the Quambies that I mentioned. I haven't mentioned this time, but I've talked about a lot, who are at Reedy Creek in South Australia, who have a wonderful nursery where their they're nurturing 34 different varieties of native foods, as well as starting community gardens in the indigenous communities and the remote communities, and they're doing very well at getting the stuff out.
So what you're calling for then doesn't sound like you're sort of like a back to an old cuisine, but a new Australian cuisine, a new hybrid mongrelised thing like we normally do very well in Australia.
That's what our cuisine is, a mongrel cuisine.
Yes, and all the better for it, of course, as well, because you mix it all up together. That's right. What you're calling for?
I'm calling for the Australian native foods to be added to the extraordinary bricolage that we gather in now. I mean, I don't know what you cook at home, but I cook all sorts of things at home, and I use all sorts of mixed ingredients. Sometimes they don't work, sometimes they do. It's the same in restaurant kitchens. I'd love to have these things, and I have had a couple of them to use and to play with at home, but not enough.
Increasingly, people are more prepared to do things like grow lemon myrtle in their backyard, aren't they?
I've got some ribaries in my backyard.
You do, right? Yeah, and that grows just fine in your backyard.
I haven't had a good crop for a couple of years for some reason. Some of the crops aren't doing all that well this year. Kujula's not doing very well. The bush tomatoes.
Well, I hope you enjoy your feast of kangaroo with ribery or pepperberry sauce tonight, John. It's been really great to speak with you, and thank you.
And to you too. Thank you very much, Richard.
John Newton is the author of The Oldest Foods on Earth, A History of Australian Native Foods.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.